Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Voice of the Underdog, a podcast exploring the relationship between challenger branding and company culture. I'm Mike Sullivan, president and CEO of Loomis, the country's leading challenger brand advertising agency, and with me is former Loomis creative director and Tuggle creative president, Michael Tuggle. Hey, Tug.
Hey.
In this episode, we're tackling what may be the buzziest of buzzwords in the marketing world right now, and that is disruption. There's a lot of brands out there waiting to disrupt things and turn the world upside down. And in many ways, that's what challenger branding is all about. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about the key role company culture plays in the whole act of disruption. Plus, you don't want to miss our conversation with Nancy Eichler, the Vice President of E-Commerce and International at Megafood, and the former Vice President of Marketing and later Global Digital and Social for Brownie Brittle, that delicious,
delicious
sweet treat, you know, that is predicated on, what are they, sort of the brownie batter edges?
It's like when you make the brownies and this part's a little overdone on the edges, but it's so good.
So we'll talk with Nancy about how she used her skills for disruption to help take Brownie Brittle from a startup to more than $50 million in sales, and why her challenger brand mindset and commitment to culture played instrumental roles in her success. This is the Voice of the Underdog podcast, and we hope you'll join us.
This episode of the Voice of the Underdog is sponsored by Luminous Sound Studios, Dallas's premier recording studio for music, production, audio post, and all things sound. For more than 25 years, Luminous Sound has been the place to go for original music for television, radio, and film, and the preferred studio for artists coast to coast. For more information, visit luminoussound.com.
Welcome back to this episode of The Voice of the Underdog. So in 1995, a paper in the Harvard Business Review first introduced the theory of disruptive innovation. And they described it as, you know, a process by which smaller, sort of undercapitalized brands could find a way to successfully challenge and disrupt really established brands, kind of take them by surprise.
Right.
And so originally the HBR authors, they kind of talked about this as a, you know, it was a real specific and narrow definition for what qualified or maybe failed to qualify as disruptive innovation. But we're 25 years away from that article. And of course, it's been hijacked and appropriated and changed in so many ways. And the theory or the term has been co-opted by marketers. We hear about this all the time.
Everybody.
Disruption. Everybody's disrupting everything, right? And ad agencies certainly are perpetrators of this hijack for sure. We love to talk about this kind of stuff. And it's become really a buzzy buzzword, you know, as we talk about it. It's kind of the battle cry for the challenger brands taking on the category killers. Disrupt
them. Everybody wants to disrupt.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, really the whole concept of disruption, and there's not another great word for it, has really been empowering dozens and dozens of brands for, you know, many, many years. And so that all changed in 2020 when COVID became the disruptor itself. And
right.
It turned the world upside down and shook it, obviously, for more than a year. And we're, you know, finally, we're working our way out of that. I don't want to be premature there because, you know, a lot of folks, you know, we're still in the middle of it.
Yeah.
So all of this disruption was really kind of catalyzed by the chaos of the global pandemic. And I mean, every brand, you know, from restaurant brands to packaged goods and healthcare service providers. I mean,
yeah, big, small,
everybody
didn't matter.
Has been turned upside down, right? And so with that as the backdrop, Michael, I will turn to you, you know, my co-author on The Voice of the Underdog. And I'll ask you, you know, what would you say to a company or a brand trying to find their way back after COVID?
Well, I think the first thing I'd say is breathe. I think take a moment and be thankful.
Right. That you're still here.
For your employees, for your customers, you know, that you even survived.
Yep.
I mean, the numbers, I remember way back a year ago, or not even a year ago, we were reading articles that, you know, restaurants, like we work with a lot of restaurants.
Yep.
75% of independent restaurants would be gone
yeah.
at the end of this.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen any updated statistics. I hope it's not 75%,
yeah.
but there's certainly a lot,
right.
you know, thousands yeah. and thousands of,
yeah.
And it's not just, well, restaurants went out of business. No, it's people's livelihoods.
That's
it's,
right.
It's
yeah.
employees with no jobs. It's people yeah. that don't have a way to pay their bills. And it's just, it is a hard thing. And it's really upset a lot, not just restaurants, but a lot of companies,
yeah.
you know? So
yeah.
I think I'd say, you know, be thankful that you're on this side of it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's no small feat.
No small feat at all. And it's entangled. I mean, there's lots of discussions to be had about this, you know, with respect to, you know, the aid that came in and whether you can get employees and all this stuff. And that notwithstanding,
yeah.
wow, what a year, you know, just take stock.
Yeah. But it's also, you know, the one silver lining, it's also an incredible opportunity for reinvention.
It is.
You know, for,
yep.
for companies of all sizes. Everybody got a reset last year. It wasn't just the challengers. It wasn't just the big companies. Everybody got it.
Yeah.
And to your point, the government stepped in and committed trillions of dollars to help people stay afloat. And in some ways, I guess COVID was the great equalizer in that way.
It was, no doubt.
But, you know, but for any challenger, I think this is the perfect time to sort of take stock and to reemerge as something bigger and better than you were before.
Yep. Yep.
There's never been another time that I can think of where every company was faced with the same relaunch,
yep.
the same, I have to rethink this, whether it's people working from home, people coming into my stores with masks mm-hmm. on, whatever.
Not coming to my stores at all.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, how do I adjust to that?
Yeah. It's yeah. like, but everybody is sort of almost starting from the same starting line now. I mean, granted, they're bigger and some are faster and whatever, but everybody is sort of had to go through this together. And so mm-hmm. you're not, I guess, as far behind the eight ball or behind the curve as you would have been as a challenger brand, let's say 2 years ago.
Right.
You know, there's an opportunity. So let me turn that question around, you know, a bit and ask you, you know, as the leader of the country's leading challenger brand agency, you know, how did you counsel the Loomis clients over the last year?
Yeah, that's interesting.
To make their way through this.
Yeah, you know, there's obviously no templated approach, and everybody was kind of making it up as they went. You know, it's sort of like flying without instruments, and the line of sight was just not there. And the number one thing that we counseled all of our clients to do was simply be flexible. You know, and take things as they came, be adaptable. And what was really interesting through all of this was just how quickly our clients were able to react and respond. You know, I think a lot of the organizations became far more nimble than they had been. And certainly we did. I think the entire agency world did. A lot of relationships were tested through this period. But, you know, remaining flexible, you know, holding the outcome loosely, you know, and obviously staying committed to doing what you do best, finding new ways to do it, were critical. And so, you know, for restaurant clients, for example, all the promotional calendars, you know, jump ball, everything went up into the air. For our healthcare clients, you know, people who weren't wanting to come in and get, you know, they weren't wanting to do office visits. There weren't opportunities for that. You know, people put off screenings, all those sorts of things. You know, but finding new ways to stay engaged with and connected to customers was critical throughout the process. And so there was no single way that companies did that, but there were some very innovative and interesting ways that they did that.
Yeah, I love how if you'd ask companies, you know, a year and a half ago about some of the things they ended up doing, well, we could never do that.
Yeah.
We could never pull that off.
Well, in the healthcare industry, for example, you know, virtual doctor's visits. I mean, and again, you know, all these trends, and this has been talked about ad nauseum, but, you know, all these trends have been, you know, fast forwarded 5 and in some cases 10 years. And so, yeah, now a virtual doctor's office visit is no big deal. Here's something interesting. So just the other day, I've got problems with sleep. You know, I'm like an insomniac. And so I'm really trying to kick this. And I downloaded a digital app or an app, but it's a digital prescription, requires a digital doctor's visit. And I did that, then downloaded the app, and it's taking me through this program. It's a CBT sort mm-hmm. of program for sleep. Wow, that's innovation. And that came right out of the pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, that was absolutely part and parcel to, you know, the disruptive circumstances caused by the pandemic.
Yeah, I just read an article yesterday that they were anticipating a billion, think about that, a billion telehealth visits
yep.
last year.
Yep.
A billion.
Yeah, and we were talking to our healthcare clients before this, and there's, you know, the interest in just telehealth medicine visits was not very high.
Yeah.
You know, just didn't think it could be accomplished.
And so, I mean, they're dentists doing it.
Yep.
I mean, mental health, I think in this article, I want to say they said 200 million of those calls were for mental health.
Yeah.
Which makes perfect sense. Why? I mean, to work with your therapist.
Yep.
Or a psychiatrist or a psychologist or whatever over the phone.
Right.
I mean, over tech.
Exactly.
Zoom or what have you. It makes a lot of sense. But so many people, no, you got to come in.
No, that's all changed. You know? And so, you know, the question is, you know, do we go back to, you know, normal? You know, and this is always interesting to me. And the whole discussion about the new normal. I mean, look, life is always changing. We're in the process of change. It was simply accelerated dramatically. And we will get back to whatever a normal looks like on the
sure.
other side of this. And we're already in process, and you can see it happening. So I think the key for marketers as we get back to what feels like a more steady state is to continue to try to think like a disruptor. You know, try to think like a competitor who is going to show up and do something unexpected. And what would that be?
Right. What would that look like? It's interesting to me when we talk about disruption. It's funny. I think you said it earlier how the term disruption has gotten co-opted over the years.
Yeah.
You know, by so many people. And honestly, I'm not even sure the original definition we talked about earlier from the HBR articles was ever going to hold up.
No.
Before COVID. You know, if you think about it, I think there were a handful of companies, you know, you can think of like Netflix and Tesla and Uber. And I think most people would generally regard those people, those companies
as
true disruptors, right?
Yep.
But what's fascinating to me is that in that 2015 article on the disruptive innovation, the authors in that article argued that it really, according to their actual theory, that Netflix, Tesla, and Uber weren't actual disruptors, which is mind-boggling to me.
Right.
I checked this morning just because I was curious.
Yep.
As of this morning, those three non-disruptor brands have a cumulative market cap north of $861 billion.
Yeah, right,
I mean, they're clearly disrupting something.
Yeah, ask their competitors if they were disruptors.
Right? I mean, they're clearly disrupting something and changing it up. But
And they should, you know, I mean, every challenger brand should be trying to disrupt the marketplace right now in some way.
You know, right.
We've seen that it's possible. We've seen, you know, just extraordinary examples of it, you know, in the restaurant industry, going to things like ghost kitchens. I mean, who would have ever thought, you know, leaning into delivery and takeout in a way that never, you know, would have been thought possible. Just 12 to 18 months ago. So
It was so interesting. What do you tell clients to say, okay, go be disruptive? I mean, to me, it's like when a client says, go be funny or go do something that's going to go viral. It's like, yeah, we can do it, but it's tough, right?
Yeah.
It's not as easy as it looks.
Yeah. If someone says, go do something that's viral, I mean, yeah, that's ordained by the consumer
right.
in large part.
Right.
I mean, that's not, we can pretend like we know how to do that, but you know, there are certainly better practices than others, but you're not going to.
Right. But to me, disruption is a little bit like that in that, there's no magic bullet, right?
Right.
It's just you gotta find your way and figure it out. But so as clients come and say, hey, we want to be disruptive, but we're really not even sure where to start.
Yeah.
Let's say you're a brand.
Right.
Hey, we want to be disruptive. We think we've got something that has the potential to do that.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even tell them where to start?
Well, yeah, that's interesting. So, you know, we've got some guidelines for that. And as part of our regular discussions and really, you know, we've got sort of five ways, I would think, at least five, but I'll start with you know, the first one, and this is great. It's right out of the book, Eating the Big Fish, you know, my favorite book. And I think just about every marketer now has it on their shelf or ought to have it on their shelf by Adam Morgan.
Right.
And he talks about, you know, the idea of intelligent naivete.
Yeah.
And that is, you know, coming to your category and forgetting everything you know, but not forgetting everything that you know as a marketer or really even more importantly as a consumer and approaching it that way. So, thinking you know, naively about the category, about your product, about your service. This, I think, also is why so often, you know, in agency reviews, you know, new agencies will come in and they will be looking at it completely differently than incumbent agency. And so it's really important for incumbent agency to be providing this sort of intelligent naivete and feedback to client. I think it's very important. You know, it's incumbent upon client too to be listening to that as well.
Sure. Well, I think it's a great centering practice just for the agency in general. I mean, or the brand or an internal company to be able to constantly say, okay, I'm not going to look at it the way we've always looked at it. Right. Or you get to where you know too much. You know, you've heard no, that won't work.
Right.
No, legally, that's not, I mean, well, you got to be careful with legal, but, you know, for whatever reason, no, that won't work. No, we can't do it that way. And you sort of get accustomed to that, and you sort of get, I don't know if you get gun-shy or just, you start pulling your punches thinking, well, that probably won't work.
Well, look what you did just there, too. Yeah. You were just talking about, well, legally, well, you do have to be careful with that. Do you? You know, again, challenge some of this stuff and really examine it. You know, we sometimes tend to think that, oh, well, because the lawyer said it, it's absolutely, it can't be done. And it's not always the case. You know, the second thing that we always talk about, and this comes right out of, you know, Blue Ocean Strategy,
which was
written years ago now. But, you know, it's looking for that open and ownable territory. They call it open water. You know, you know, where is the space that nobody is really occupying and occupying well? And in crowded categories, that can be difficult to spot, but I promise you it's there.
Yeah. It's one of our, you know, the brands we talk a lot about in the book, obviously Netflix, I mean, one of the great challenger brands of the last, you know, decade or whatever. But it's always amazing to me every time I review that story, you know, and I think about Reed Hastings and his partner going to the leaders at Blockbuster and saying, hey, we see this blue ocean out here for, you know, sending DVDs through the mail and then eventually for streaming and for $50 million,
right.
You could own us outright and Blockbuster's like, we got this.
No, we got this. Hold my beer.
Yeah. It's amazing to me that, you know, sometimes there are people who see it and sometimes you just, it's right there, but you just don't see it.
Yeah.
And you gotta, I mean, you gotta be willing to sort of jump out there and,
yeah, because I think we just, as human beings, we just have a natural tendency to get invested in the status quo, you know, and it's very difficult to break out of that. It is safe. You know, so the third one that we love to talk about is this whole idea of overlaying. Mm-hmm. And so it's a category overlay. And, you know, there's lots of examples. I have to tell you, my very favorite personal example is Lush. You know, the Lush brand. Have you been to the mall and seen Lush doors, all the soap and all that stuff?
It's like a farmer's market.
Yeah. And like, you know, I'm an average dude. You know, I'm not really into soap, you know, but I will tell you, when I saw that store, I was so intrigued by it. First of all, as you walk by it, you're just overpowered with, it's like a sensory experience, certainly olfactory. You know, you just can't help but smell this goodness in this crazy place. And what was interesting is that the as I understand it, the way they came up with that concept, and for those who aren't familiar with it, you walk into a Lush brand store and there's bath bombs, there's soap, and it's laid out very much like a
cheese shop.
Well, yeah, in the produce department, like an upscale grocer, you know, almost like going to Whole Foods. And I think that's how they got the idea. Going to Whole Foods, look at the way the product is displayed. Now, what would that look like overlaid on a, you know, very uninteresting category
on
like
soap
products? Right. And boom, you wind up with Lush. And so that's the idea of overlaying. What can you borrow from another category that works really well? And how would that look in your category? And what a fun, you know, thing to do. I think the restaurant industry, frankly, does some of this very well. I mean, there's a lot of creativity in the restaurant industry. I think that's why agency folks like it so much. And I know that's why we do. But overlaying is just a brilliant tactic.
And one of the things I love so much about Lush is the way they took it. They didn't just sort of take it, like a little bit.
Oh, no.
They took it all the way through to the point that, so if I go in there and buy, you know, I buy a chunk of soap.
Right.
Like,
they wrap it
by the quarter pound.
Yeah.
Which has got to be more profitable for them than just a bar of soap. But you do that, they wrap it up in butcher paper.
Yep.
They have big, you know, the wicker looking or the barrels that you'd see apples in the grocery. It used to be in the farmer's market, you know, the little barrels or little baskets.
Yep.
They have soap bombs like that. It looks like apples. They're pink. They're, you know. They took the concept and went all the way through with it.
They did. So to the wall.
Yeah.
So overcommitment. And that is another key factor in terms of challenger branding. Overcommit to what it is you're doing. So, yeah, Lush brand stuff. I mean, it's on the shopping list for my daughter and wife every birthday, holiday, you know, all that good stuff.
It's great.
You know, the fourth one is, you know, in terms of just sort of guidelines here, is really just to partner with smart thinkers. And that's obvious, but it's obvious, but it's like a huge difference maker. You know, when you've got other folks in the room who are, you know, passionate about their craft, love, you know, the everything marketing, advertising, it makes a big difference, you know, than folks who are just maybe not as committed.
Well, I think, I think as a leader of a company, I think sometimes you can get in your own head and think, I have to be the one to make the decisions. I have to be the one to solve the problem or to come up with the big idea or
to
whatever.
To be the smartest one in the room.
Yeah.
To have the answers. And you can get tied up in that.
Yeah. And I think you paint yourself into the corner of being the one person.
Right.
Right. You have thinkers at your disposal in your own company, but also in the agency. I mean, I think back, the clients we've done the best with and have had the best success with over the years were the ones that allowed us to wade in hip deep.
Yeah, absolutely.
They trusted us. Yep. You can sign NDAs, whatever you want to do, fine. Mm. But, you know, but they trusted us with the challenges they had in front of them, even sometimes when they weren't even our problems to solve. I mean, every now and then we'd have a client go, look, this is not what we're paying you for. This is not what we expect you to do, but we're struggling with this.
Right.
And man, we'd love to have your brains on this for an hour or whatever. And we loved that.
Turns out, you know, creativity is a great tool for solving business problems.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Down the ladder.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then the last thing I would say on this tug is that, you know, just enjoy the process, right? Have fun, you know,
absolutely.
Especially from a marketing and advertising standpoint. I mean, that's why I got into this business. It's the creative side of business and it's fun. You know, we enjoy this. It's problem solving. It's a place where your intellect and curiosity is rewarded, you know, dive in, you know, as you said, hip deep, you know, and go after it. So
absolutely.
Yeah. Those would be my things.
You know, truthfully, if a brand did even two or three of those things, they'd be way ahead of the game.
They would indeed. So, well, anyway.
Well, speaking of getting ahead, I cannot wait to talk to our guest for the podcast, my friend and classmate, Nancy Eichler. If anyone knows what it feels like to fight the uphill challenger battle, it's Nancy.
Yep.
And we know you're going to be inspired and enlightened by our discussion with her. And that's coming up next.
I can't wait. Let's talk to Nancy. All right, joining us now is Nancy Eichler, an advertising and marketing leader who certainly understands disruption and what it means to fight the fight of the underdog. So here's just a quick top line of Nancy's impressive background. She's the former director at AOL, where she managed $200 million in ad sales and e-commerce client relationships with brands like Amazon, Target, the NFL, Barnes & Noble, and Ralph Lauren. She was also VP of marketing and then VP for global digital and social at Brownie Brittle. And now Nancy is VP of e-commerce and international at Megafood, the premium vitamin and supplement company that's on a mission to, quote, grow a healthier world. Welcome, Nancy, to the Voice of the Underdog podcast.
Thank you. Thank you, guys. I'm really excited to be here. And, you know, I actually have a question for you. Do you have a dog that is your, you know, sort of the mascot?
Well, there's, okay, so gosh, you know, I have a little Boston Terrier and I'm going to call him the mascot. He's a COVID puppy, you know, and there's many COVID puppies and now he's about a year and a half old and he is just awesome. So he's my mascot. But there
Excellent.
Is no shortage of dogs here at the Loomis agencies that I think people would call mascots. What do you think, Tug?
I think Archie's the perfect dog for that. He's got more energy than any dog I know. He's the perfect challenger pup, but he's great. But yeah, on any given day, you'll have a dozen dogs running around, it's awesome for the culture. I mean, it was something we started forever
years ago.
I mean, it was started off, well, we'll sign up. We have a sign-up sheet. You can bring one dog on per Friday. And then it became, well, everybody just bring your dog on Friday. And then it became, you know what, just bring them whenever. Just
bring the dogs, yeah.
And it was great. Clients love it. We love it. So it was awesome.
Yeah, they've been coming ever since. And thank you, Nancy, for giving me the opportunity to mention my dog on our podcast.
Yeah, he was real upset. He didn't get mentioned in the first three, so.
For sure. So I have to tell you, before a couple of weeks ago, I had never tried Brownie Brittle. Michael is the one who introduced me to it, and oh my gosh, you know, it's definitely a feature in our household now. I don't think there's any extracting it, and I bought just a ton of it for upstairs at the agency. It's in the pantry, and I think it's already gone. Wow, what a product. I mean, really something.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess some people might say thank you to Michael, and some people might blame him.
Oh.
Curse you!
Yeah. Oh, it's sort of an embarrassing situation. I bought a bag when we started talking about this again. I thought, I'm gonna go have some now. And so I went bought a bag, and I opened it up, and I took out three or four of them, and then I went and sat down and watched TV, and then like I don't know, 5 minutes later, I got up and went and opened the bag again, and
there were
about seven trips, I think, before I finally just said stop.
No, it will test your discipline.
You got to stop.
It will test your discipline.
Yeah, we used to say it really should say it's one serving,
right?
And just call it lunch.
Yeah, exactly. Or at least come
I don't
with
know why they put a zip seal on there sometimes.
Right,
you're
right.
Opening that bag, you're not closing it.
No.
In fact, mine actually came with a little chip clip. It was kind of cool.
Oh, did it? That's awesome.
Yeah. Well, anyway, before we dive into your just incredible challenger story with Brownie Brittle and now Mega Food, I'd like to go just a little further back in your career to when you were at AOL and what that was like really before e-commerce and the digital world became what we all know it is now. I mean, that's awfully interesting.
Yeah, AOL was a ton of fun. You know, it was probably among the smartest group of people I've ever worked with. They were just so passionate and committed to doing something different. We knew that, you know, we were really changing the way people did business, the way people interacted with each other, the way people shopped, did commerce. Yeah. And it was really exciting. I think the hardest thing was that, you know, a lot of people didn't really completely understand it, weren't sure if they trusted it. So if you remember way back when, there were, you know, certifications like authorized.net certification. People didn't want to put their credit card information into a form that they didn't know who was taking it. You know, where are they taking it to? Is it going to be posted on some, you know, website somewhere? And so there was a lot of trust issue there that we had to build credibility and comfort. And so we did a lot to offer when we built the shopping channel, all of our customers were certified, AOL certified, and we had this list of like 25 different processes they went through in order to become certified so the consumers could feel comfortable engaging with us. But I would say, so it was a lot, you know, when you're we say challenger, and I guess there folks can sometimes look at challenger brands versus disruptor brands as being a little bit different. I would say that, you know, AOL was certainly a disruptor, really creating new industry. And so when consumers, we had to gain credibility with them, comfort with them, as well with businesses that knew nothing about this new space.
Yep.
And so convincing them that they should trust us with building a site or set up, you know, media spend for them, building landing pages, things like that. There was a lot of education that went on back then.
Yeah, you know, that whole privacy journey is just so fascinating, too. It's another podcast, but I mean, the arc of time and where we've come with respect to the privacy issue and the trust issue, all of this, it's sort of interwoven. I mean, how fascinating to have been on the ground floor of that.
Yeah, it was a really exciting time, you know, and I think that people really were committed to trying new things, seeing if they worked, seeing what a consumer said. But you know what was really one of the most fascinating moments at AOL was actually, you know, if you recall, it was when there were different companies that were coming in doing a flat rate price, mm-hmm. and AOL at the time was doing hourly. And right, so right. there became this massive bandwidth issue as AOL shifted, and this was 1996, from an hourly model to a flat rate model. And so, you know, several of our content components went from being princes to paupers literally overnight, because the goal had been keep them online as long as possible, because you wanted to, you know, rack up those hours and let the consumer really enjoy themselves. So things like games and chat.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden games and chat, it was more like, well, hold on a second. How do we make money if they're staying online for hours? And then there was a whole dial-up issue. If you remember, people couldn't get online.
The modems.
Yeah. So we used to walk down the aisles of airplanes, and we would cover up our AOL gear because, you know, people would attack you in the aisles.
Yeah.
I can't get online. I need, you know, give me a phone number.
Oh my gosh.
We knew we were really, you know, had become part of the fabric of, I think, the American, you know, way of engaging with each other and getting their information, because they were now so mindful of who we were and, you know, ready to come after us. So we knew things were starting to calm down and access was getting easier when your friends and family stopped calling you up.
Yeah.
And bugging you about it.
Wow. I mean, just such an interesting time.
It was. I mean, what was the culture like in the middle of all of that? Things changing so quickly and.
You know, the culture at AOL, like I said, you know, such a smart group of people. And I just felt like everyone was still so committed to what we were trying to do. So it was, we're going to have to rethink video games. It's not that they shouldn't exist, right? It was just a different strategy for how they exist and which types of video games and what types of content. Because ultimately, we knew that we still wanted consumers to heavily engage with all of these resources. It's just, you know, and this was the world of digital where, you know, and it's still this way today. Somebody who existed, you know, a couple of years ago may not today, and they might have been hugely disruptive when they initially came, you know, to be, and then they're gone in an instant. So you think of the likes of CompuServe, right?
Yep.
Or Netscape.
Yep. Right.
And not always the best brands win, right? Some of them win because they are better marketers,
no doubt.
How they engage with a consumer or business.
Yep.
Yeah. It's crazy. So how do you go from AOL then to Brownie Brittle?
So, you decide to have children and you decide that you're going to take a little time off. And coming back to work, I found myself at this weird, this fork in the road where I had too much experience for several of the positions I said I was willing to take, but not enough experience or not recent enough experience. Mm-hmm. So I literally ended up hanging up a shingle and just doing marketing consulting. And as I was doing that, I came across an article in our local paper here in South Florida, the Palm Beach Post. And I read about this woman, Sheila Maines, who had created this product and was interested in taking it to QVC and was interested in launching a website and promoting it. And so as I read about her, I literally picked up the phone and called her and said, hey, I've had products on QVC. I worked with QVC.com, and I certainly have worked with plenty of websites and can help you there. Would you be interested in getting together? So that's literally how it all came about. Came out from just a cold call.
That's awesome. Well, breaking into the categories that you guys obviously had to go after, like grocery and retail and snacks, I mean, those are notoriously difficult to get shelf space and to even, you know, find your way in there. How did you guys decide even to where to start?
Well, I think what I looked at was, you know, you need awareness, right, in order to get your products purchased, whether it's to put on shelf or pull through to have it off of shelf. by the consumer. And in order to get it on shelf, we knew we needed some sort of validation or credibility. And the only thing that I could think of at the time was we need to win awards with this product. And if we win awards, then, you know, we can share that. We can do press releases and we can share that information. We can take it around to trade shows and things and convince retailers that they want to potentially put us on shelf. In addition to that, I actually look at a startup and I think about the digital space. And of course, that was, you know, my most comfortable zone to be in, having been at AOL for so many years. And what I thought was, you know, digital, a lot of times people will say it levels the playing field for a startup. I actually think it tilts the playing field in favor of the startup. And so we went after digital. And I loved social media because this was a place for us to speak directly to the consumer and not only get the consumer to purchase our product either from our website or from a site like Amazon, but also to have the consumers. We actually had a page on our site that the consumer could download and fill out a form and take it to their local retailer and ask them to carry our product.
Nice. Yeah. Smart. Really smart.
Yeah. Yeah. So the whole idea was really engaging with as many people as we possibly could, as quickly as we possibly could to help us in this process.
You know, and Michael and I talked a little bit about your social strategy and working with some of the early social firms and maybe you've worked with more than one when you were with Brownie Brittle, but the level of engagement that you were looking for and the level of engagement that some of the agencies were willing to provide was different. Can you talk just a little bit about that? Because that, I think, is really, I think it illustrates some of that challenger hustle, which is just so critical to making challenger brands succeed, you know, helping them.
Yeah. Well, I felt like if this is, and this is still how I feel today, but I don't work so much on social today, but my feeling is if somebody comes through, if you have a retail storefront and somebody walks through your door and they say, "Hey, I love your stuff." To me, if you don't talk to them, it's disrespectful. You know, you want to thank them, but to me, it wasn't just about liking their posts. It was actually having a dialogue in the same way you would had they come in your retail storefront. And that's how I felt that they were gifting us this opportunity to engage with them and possibly make a deeper connection.
Right.
And so I was so committed to that approach on every platform at every level. We even had Sheila had her own Facebook page. So it was both her, you know, everybody who engages with her, I would, you know, kind of insist working with her. And luckily she was a partner in all of this. She was absolutely a believer, you know, in talking to her fans. And so the combination of, you know, her commitment, as well as this idea that, you know, we really wanted to one by one win over these fans even more, such that they would turn back around and go back out and sort of share the love for us.
Yeah. And in the early days, especially on social, that was the big promise, is we can go one-to-one and really do that authentically. And I think maybe in some cases we've lost a thread on that a little bit, you know, with what you see. But certainly there's still great examples. So you know that we're obviously big fans of the challenger mindset. And, you know, Michael was sharing the story about ironing the Brownie Brittle bags. And I'd love you to tell our listeners about that. That's fantastic.
Well, in a startup, you know, you do everything that you can to help it succeed. And, you know, you don't have loads of people around to just, you know, pick up the garbage or, you know, take care of your laptop for you. You know, if you needed any sort of technology, if you needed, you know, Comcast, you were having to call them. If you needed, you know, the floor swept, you were having to do it. And so, you know, I go from a very young age. My father had a commercial air conditioning business where I grew up. And my very first real job was cleaning his office building. So I think that mindset of there's no task too low for you, that we just believed that anything that needed to be done, we were bodies willing to do it.
I love
and
that.
So I have gone down to the bakery several times in the early days where, you know, helping them weigh bags and make sure they were the right, you know, weight. And we had an issue where bags came in and there were, they had pre-applied labels to them and the labels were wrong. And so we had to iron the bags in order to remove those labels. Other companies probably would have just disposed of those bags
yeah.
and bought new bags, but we couldn't afford to.
Wow.
You know, we
Love
were
it.
Doing everything we could just to keep the lights on. And in that world where, you know, you're having to pay your bakery before you're getting paid for the product that was on shelf.
Yep.
And so it's sort of that you got to float those funds.
Yeah.
In between, and things like, you know, errors on bags, we just had to do whatever we could do in order to, you know, in order to keep ourselves from bleeding cash.
And that just goes to mindset. It's just doing yeah. whatever it takes, which is just an underpinning of all just great challenger brands. So, Nancy, when did you realize that you guys really had something special on your hands with this brand?
Well, fairly early on, I would say that we were less than a year live with our product, and we started receiving some requests for our product. You know, I saw every single order that came through the system. I saw who ordered it, what the email address was, where the product was being sent to, and there was somebody who was ordering from Pepperidge Farms. And so I thought, well, hold on a second. You know, why would they do this? They're are they interested in partnering with us? So Sheila and I sat down and tried to figure out, well, how are we going to handle this? Do we actually send them product? Because now they've never spoken to us. Is there a fear that they're going to knock us off?
Yeah.
Well, heck, they could maybe, you know, I know we were young, but maybe they want to acquire us
yeah.
for the right price. We were open
sure.
to the idea of it. But what happened, you know, then we tried to be creative about how we handled it. We didn't want them to believe that we were extremely savvy. There was a concern that if we were too sharp for them, that they might know that we knew what they were up to. So we really wanted them to keep their guard down. Well, we didn't send the shipment to them when they ordered. So then they called back and Sheila actually answered the phone and asked them. So they didn't know they're talking to the creator of the product,
yeah.
right? They just
I
think they're
it.
Calling a customer service line. And Sheila answered the phone. The phone number is 1-800-BROWNIE. So it was a great vanity number.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they were asking her, trying to explain that they had an event coming up that weekend and they really needed the product and they were in love with, you know, brownie brittle. And could we please send them, you know, expedited shipping, the brownie brittle. And, you know, so what we did is we actually got very creative. And we went to Costco and we bought, or I should say Sheila bought, these little mini brownies because she was also in the brownie business at the time, and bought little mini brownies. And we sent them a ton of like brownie snack related products, none of which were brownie brittle.
Love it.
Love it.
So that they
yeah.
would think
yeah.
that we were a mess.
You sandbagged them. I love it.
Yes.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. That's a great tactic. So and, I, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Then they
yeah.
called us up.
Yep.
You know, again, begging us, and one woman, and I'll never forget her name, but I can't share it with you, but she called us up and she said, this was through, mind you, just a regular Gmail account. And she said, so now they were resorting to, first they were shipping to Pepperidge Farms. Now this was another individual saying, oh, I love your product so much. I need it by Saturday. Can you overnight me the product? And it was Friday.
Wow.
And I spoke to her. Well, first I spoke to her begging me that it was like for a family event. And she really needed this. Long story short, I call Pepperidge Farm and I say, yeah, I'd like to speak to this individual. And sure enough, they can connect me to her voicemail. So I know she works at Pepperidge Farm.
Mm-hmm.
So of course we sent nothing. And I explained to her, oh, we're having horrible problems with our fulfillment center right now. And I'm not sure that we're going to be able to get the product to you. Where we landed ultimately, I'm not going to, you know, it's one thing if you walk in a retail store and you buy up my product, I can't stop you.
Right.
But I'm not going to serve my destiny to you on a silver platter.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding.
No. At very least, have an intern call.
Yeah. Whatever happened with that? Was that sort of the end of that?
Sheila did end up getting on the phone with them and said, and flat out told them. So after the weekend was over, and obviously we had missed the deadline, or the shipping deadline, then Sheila actually spoke to someone else at Pepperidge Farm and said, hey, with all due respect, if you want our product, you're going to have to work harder than just ordering it off our own site with your Pepperidge Farm email address.
I love it. Yeah.
But otherwise, if you want to partner with us, I'd be all too happy to come and sit with you.
Yeah.
Otherwise, good luck. I'm not sending this to your bakery.
All right. That's perfect. Well, gosh, I love all your examples of the little things that you guys did, you know, to build the relationships with your customers too, which was just a whole nother, you know, group of activities and things that you did really almost one at a time. And it's an awesome reminder that, you know, being a challenger brand is very difficult, you know, and even dealing with things like, you know, the story that you just described. I mean, there's nothing easy about that. It takes a whole lot of work and persistence, but it's also, you know, at the customer level, so important to create, you know, not just customers, but brand evangelists. And I would imagine for a brand like Brownie Brittle, there are just a ton of evangelists. And do you have any sort of favorite brand evangelist stories that you can share with us?
Yeah, we had, you know, again, early on, I think it was maybe 2013 or 14, we found out, and, you know, if you listen to your fan base, they're going to tell you what's happening with your brand. They're going to tell you what's wrong with your product. If you ever have, you know, if there's a bad taste or there's a product texture inconsistency, if their product is lacking somewhere distribution wise, where, you know, maybe a flavor has been out of stock for a while. And if you pay close enough attention, right, they'll tell you things before you could find them out otherwise.
Right.
And so that was something that we did a lot of, was really listen to our fans, whether through phone calls or emails or postings on social. And there was a gentleman who was an attorney in the Midwest who contacted us and told us that, hey, why is the Midwest Costco discontinuing your product? We didn't know they were discontinuing it. So we immediately got on the phone with the Costco Midwest region to understand what was happening, to find out if in fact this gentleman was right. Turns out he was. And then this gentleman, I started, you know, emailing him, thanking him for the information and telling him what he could do to try to help us get back into Costco. So we also did some postings on social encouraging consumers, hey, go into your Costco Midwest region, tell them if you don't want the product pulled from shelves, go tell them. And suddenly this guy who, you know, I never personally knew him, but he took it upon himself. He took up a letter writing campaign. He even wrote from his own legal office and, you know, on his letterhead telling Costco to please bring this product in or back in.
Wow.
And sure enough, within weeks after we reached out to our fan base and told them that this was happening, we received a call from Costco. They apparently had always intended to bring us back in.
Yeah.
They were going to take us out of rotation and put us back in later, but they brought us in about 6 to 8 weeks earlier than was anticipated.
Wow. That's fantastic. Yeah. The power of customer pull and love in that case. And what were those 6 weeks worth, right? From a sales standpoint?
Yeah.
I mean, really, that's outstanding.
Yeah.
So, you know, how do you handle the other side of that? You know, when you know, maybe an evangelist is disappointed in some respects.
Yeah, we had, you know, we certainly would have some negative posts. I think one in particular that I recall was with you know, when maybe somebody isn't politically aligned with an organization. And in this case, we had just launched in Cracker Barrel and we were very excited and had shared online, you know, we're now in Cracker Barrel. And we had several posts from people who were saying that I'm never going to purchase your products. And, you know, we said, by all means, it's your choice to do what you want, but we are not a political organization by any stretch. However, if you feel like you want to know who we are, don't judge us just by our brittle. Look at the organizations that we've supported along the way. Look at, you know, we had Cookies for Kids Cancer was a big partnership we had at the time, and their logos were on the backs of all of our bags. In addition, we were doing a lot of philanthropic work, the Miami Children's Hospital, and other, you know, organizations. And so we encourage that, you know, really understand who a brand is before, you know, you go after them. And I'm sure in today's cancel culture, you know, that would even go further. Like, don't just take it on surface value. You know, go a little deeper and understand who this brand is. And lo and behold, then our own audience started kind of, you know, speaking for us. So well, I put defense. One post up and, you know, and then our audience jumped in and started speaking on our behalf saying, hey, listen, if they're supporting these organizations and you don't like Cracker Barrel, then actually buying their product through Cracker Barrel is further supporting, you know, these organizations. So maybe you might want to rethink it. And then we had, you know, I would poke fun at things like, the in Deflategate with the Patriots. You know, we did a funny graphic of a deflated football next to a bag of brownie brittle. And it said, some say the flatter the snacks, the better the grip. And yeah, we had a lot of Patriots fans, not a lot. We had a handful of Patriots fans who said, I will never buy your product again. And I said, oh, we sure all ingest. And please let us send you a free bag so you can enjoy it during your, you know, what will likely be your another Super Bowl victory for you. And so, and they were like, oh, I was just kidding. You know, I love brownie brittle. Thank you so much. I will take that bag. So anyone who was upset over it, we went ahead and we comped them a bag of product, knowing that, you know, really, it's just a snack. We're just having fun.
It's amazing how people's responses will shift or change when they feel heard. And that's really what you did there. It's just, it's sort of a magic move. It's just, I acknowledge you, I hear you, and you can flip that sort of thing. You know, navigating the whole political environment, cancel culture, all that, I think that's a particular challenge for brands nowadays. And it sounds like you did a great job of that with Brownie Brittle. It's, I think it's only getting more challenging for marketers, and it's certainly a watch out. You've got to be very deliberate about that.
It's hard. You almost have to decide, I'm going to say nothing, or I'm going to be so measured in every single thing that you say. It's just, you know, it's hard to have.
Yeah, you can get stuck in a corner pretty quick.
You can. So Nancy, tell us a little bit about your current company. I mean, we talked a lot about Brownie Brittle. It's kind of from the startup side of things. Mega Food is obviously very different from a startup.
Mega Food. You know, it's how Mega Food came to be. One day driving the brownie brittle van around, we were coming back from a trade show, and one of my colleagues and I, you know, I was driving the van, and she, you know, I pulled over to the side of the road because I was like sweating and having these heart palpitations, and I was really panicked that, you know, like I was dying or something. And I pulled over and I said to her, I described my symptoms and I said, so if you need to, if I pass out and you need to call 911, this is what you're going to tell them. And she was obviously a little freaked out. And unfortunately we had no food other than brownie brittle in the van. So, you know, I downed a bunch of water and, you know, I did eat a little bit of brownie brittle.
Got your sugar up anyway.
I ended up being okay. And I drove back. Long story short, I ended up having low potassium. And so I had to look for a potassium supplement. And when I went out and did my homework, I went on to Amazon and ended up ordering Mega Food. So I was on the supplement for a couple of years. And while at Brownie Brittle, another mutual friend who had, or a friend of mine who had been at Brownie Brittle prior, had said to me, "Oh my gosh, I see this job description. It has you written all over it," because she and I used to talk a lot about health and well-being and, you know, nutrition. I had gotten my holistic health certification in nutrition back in 2010. So I had always been in this mindset of, you know, you can use your powers for good or for evil,
right.
You know?
Yeah.
And I didn't want to keep, you know, marketing products that people didn't need, couldn't afford. And so I really loved the idea of working for a company that was, you know, so kind of aligned with where I am from a health perspective, that they're a certified B Corp. Mm. They are, you know, so deeply principled. They do, you know, even they've been in premium supplements for decades. They're not somebody new to the market yeah. that is, you know, just saying all the things a consumer wants to hear. You know, they're yeah. very deliberate about everything they do, every product they produce. And I was just so impressed with them. Hmm. So I went over to them in July of 2018. And I think, you know, one of the things that I just love is that the company is a pioneer in the movement to make regenerative agriculture a widespread reality. And I just really love that concept.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Doing well by doing good.
Yeah, that's it.
Exactly.
And that underpins the entire sort of B Corp framework,
yeah.
which is outstanding. So, yeah, well, really awesome stuff here. Kind of wind this up with just a quick question around culture. You know, so we've been talking with you about, you know, your experience at AOL, you know, Brownie Brittle, and now Megafood. And I know that you also believe that great company culture is critical for success. You know, we talk about how really brands are driven by culture. You know, mm-hmm. it's kind of a secret mm-hmm. ingredient. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that as we kind of wind it down a little bit.
Yeah, I think that, you know, when I think about company culture, it's interesting. You know, a lot of times when a company grows really fast, the culture can change,
yep.
right? You have that sort of that early mindset, the true entrepreneur that roll up their sleeves and do whatever they can. And most of the people who jump on early on are very committed to the mission, mm-hmm. right? And sometimes as you go along, if you lose your way, you will lose your customer base.
Yeah.
You will lose sales. I mean, it all kind of goes, there's a reason that consumers first were attracted to the brand or that businesses were first attracted to the brand. And so I think it's really important, to stay humble
yep.
through all of that.
For sure.
So when I think about culture, I think about maintaining humility, because even, you know, a lot of these challenger brands, there's a heavy belief, but that belief is always that it can change in an instant. And if you keep that in mind, that you always have to deliver that value that you said you were going to deliver, and maintain that culture through that process, I think that you'll continue to see success. But yeah, if you lose your way, and I think there are a lot of companies that do,
yep.
sometimes when VC firms come in, or when a lot of hires happen in a short period of time, you can lose your way. And it's important to continue to check on that.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And it's great advice as well. Well, gosh, thank you, Nancy, so much for joining us on The Voice of the Underdog. It's been a real pleasure on our end.
Thanks, Nancy.
Thank you guys very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nancy. We'll talk soon.
All right. Take care.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Voice of the Underdog podcast. We hope you feel it was time well spent and that you enjoyed the conversations. If you'd like to know more about challenger branding and how you can build the kind of company culture that changes the game, order a copy of The Voice of the Underdog, How Challenger Brands Create Distinction by Thinking Culture First at Amazon or Barnes & Noble. Big thanks to our friend Nancy Eichler for sharing her insights and wisdom with us today. Thanks to our sound engineer, Joey Lomas, and Luminous Sound Studios for hosting us. Don't miss our next episode coming soon, when we'll look at the intersection of challenger branding and company culture and make our case for why HR and marketing really need to share an office. For my co-author, Mike Sullivan, I'm Michael Tuggle. Thanks for joining us. This is The Voice of the Underdog.